Well, the good news is we'll be able to avoid the part about Aldecar because Mr. Fish has been able to cover that quite effectively. And the bad news is there's too many others to get through all of the slides, so I'm probably going to just sit here on this slide for a second and just try to hit the highlights. The pollinator protection thing is still in play, and if y'all remember the MP3 plans we had talked about and tried to encourage, and EPA is still trying to evaluate that. So they came out with this rule that said, hey, on pesticides that are acutely toxic, we're going to impose some restrictions on crops that have requirements for pollination service. For those crops that do not require pollination service, we are going to wait and see how these MP3 plans work, these state pollinator protection plan, see how those work to try to mitigate these risks. So if your state does not have one, I would encourage you to try to get your state to get one quick. They are still in play. They are still a major thing that EPA is looking at. And right now I'm on another committee that is trying to determine, well, how does EPA look at them and determine a metric to say that they are or are not working. But for the next couple of years, they are giving us something that is kind of holding off on trying to pass mandated regulations. So there was several postings come up on some sulfonyl urea that EPA had some concerns trying to look at. Some of their water model has raised some questions around these products and whether or not they were contaminating some ecosystem areas. We've submitted a lot of comments on that. At this point, they seem to be moving forward without cancellation of those products, but we're keeping a close eye on that. Methoxyfenoside is one of the insect growth regulators. EPA came out with a proposal on that. We went in and visited with them. One of the odd things about the way that they do it is they have shortened the time interval down to say, okay, you allowed a maximum of 10 days between applications, and the maximum single application is this amount. So if you apply this amount 10 days later, you apply this amount, then you've used your season total, and we're finding that there's accumulation. And I told him, I said, well, if it was ever used that way, that might have some kind of validity. But these are not products that are used that way. So they look at things through worst-case scenarios, and then all of that gets picked up and put into a modeling system to try to determine what they think the worst-case scenario would be. But we have visited with them quite a bit on that, tried to fine-tune some of the understanding around that, which offered some mitigations to try to alleviate a lot of their concerns around that. I'm going to focus a little bit on the organophosphates as a collective group. But in the organophosphates, you would have Bidrin, Malathion, your defoliant Tribuphos, which is in Finnish and DEF. You would have Dicrotophos, which would be Bidrin. So you see there's a whole lot that's in organophosphates, right? And organophosphates have been under attack before, and they're under a major attack right now. Where it all stems from right now is EPA has got this new study that came out from a university, in Columbia University, that they did a study when mothers were expecting, and whenever it could be used in homes. And they said, okay, we studied these mothers, we took a blood sample at birth, and then we followed these children for 7 years, and we believe that there is an association between exposure and a 4-point drop in IQ at the end of that 7-year period. Now, that would raise concern in people's head until the scientist really sits down and looks and says, wait, you know, you're talking about an association. What is the cause? Well, they don't know the cause. It would be a total new cause for organophosphates, something that we didn't know existed, but we can't identify what this cause would be. So then they asked the university for the data, and the university says, no, we're not going to give you our data. We've told you what our data says, and that's where we're going to leave it. Now, EPA requires data from all of the companies to make any decisions, and they require the companies to do those studies under good laboratory practices, which are very high scrutinized studies. Yet, in this particular study, which contradicts 40 years of previous studies, EPA has said, well, we're going to go with this study then, and we're going to apply new safety factors on all organophosphates. The study was just done with one organophosphate, and remember that it's an association through an epidemiology study that EPA itself has already pointed out all kind of confounding errors and problems within the study, yet they have adopted that study and are applying new safety factors on all organophosphates. And those new safety factors are just multipliers that they add into the risk assessment and blow the risk assessment out of the water to where that you can't mitigate it and where that it will make a suggestion that there are health claims that there's nothing to substantiate or support. But yet that's what they're living with. So in that scenario, that has put us in human health risk assessments for a lot of products. Now, I've asked them point blank, if it was not for that 10X safety factor, would we be having this discussion? And they said no. If it was not for them adopting this new safety factor, we would not be facing any health risk. It's totally around this new safety risk factor. So it's a major change in policy. It's a major change in direction. EPA has never gone off of these epidemiology studies before because they are not easily replicated. They are not easily explained because they are more associations rather than understanding a cause. So there's a lot of work going on around these right now, but just want you to know that a lot of the organophosphates are under pressure, and EPA is looking at cutting rates, at looking at cutting applications, restricting everything around them. Worker protection standards, for those of you who do not know, who may have missed it, worker protection standards changed. EPA adopted a final rule for worker protection standards. The new worker protection standards is much, much stricter. There are several of the old exemptions that were in worker protection standards that are now removed. For instance, if you look at the area about rinse water and cleaning water, no longer is a pond out there close to the field an acceptable alternative. There are no alternatives. Now you are required at the beginning of the work day to provide each worker with the specified amount, and they specify the amount. Each worker is to be provided the specified amount of rinse water and ocular rinse water and clean rags for decontamination. The posting of fields has changed. The REI around when you've got to post, it is now required if the REI is greater than 48 hours that within a certain time limit you have that field posted at all entry sites to that field. It is also required that that posting be removed 24 hours after that REI expires. So you can't just go ahead and post everything and be done for the year. It's requiring putting up and taking down. So if you don't know, check with your local, with your state groups to understand all of the changes. It also now requires worker protection training on an annual basis. So there are many major changes, new sections added to the training requirements. Move on past that. There's another one being put out on certification and training where they're trying to raise the bar on certain uses and expand a whole lot of training around that. Right now, that rule has been put on hold. They had it out for comment. They'd got comments in, and something has happened that EPA has come out with an announcement that one is on hold. So we're still monitoring where that goes. Sulfoxaflor, everyone has seen the sulfoxaflor label that came out. You know the court decision that took sulfoxaflor out and sent it back to EPA. EPA came back and put a new registration out, but that registration that they released did not have cotton on the label. They also did not have other crops on the label that have bloom, which is where EPA is trying to just make automatic assumptions that if a crop blooms, bees are present. So then they're going to make restrictions based off of that. And we are debating and arguing with them about that right now. But that's currently what they did with sulfoxaflor. There are Section 18s that are severe emergency exemptions that they have been granting. And they have, we in a recent visit, they agreed that they will continue to work with us on these Section 18s while the company is developing the data for a full Section 3 label. They made it clear also that once that full Section 3 label is released, that Section 18s will be out of the question to change any rate around that. Moving on to the neonics, imidacloprid was the first one that they released a pollinator protection assessment on. If you look at that, it's thick as one of the dictionaries, just on pollinator risk assessment. And they're still trying to figure out if they want to add to it and require more information. But in the announcement around that, they announced that their preliminary look says that cotton is a high risk to pollinators. Now, what I need all of you to understand is that this is setting precedent. It means whatever we're doing right now, whichever company makes the first move and accepts the first deal with EPA, sets the stage what everything else has to go through. So whatever gets settled now for a neonic, then your acephate and all of that comes back up for re-registration every 15 years, has to meet that as a minimum. So we're in some very sensitive areas right now where that everybody has to work very close together to make sure we do not set precedents that knock a lot of products out in the future. We are still working. In fact, next Monday we are sitting down with the agency to talk about this. One of the areas that the Cotton Council has talked with corn and soybean about, and we all feel comfortable with, is that this is based off of the presence of managed hives. An assumption that hives are present, but they are not always present. So if a restriction is required, we believe that restriction should clearly spell out what it's being, why it's being restricted. And such language would be something that would say, this product is toxic to bees. Do not use this product if managed bees are within 500, 1,500 feet of the field. And we believe that that provides the protection for the beekeepers and allows many acres to still receive the crop protection practices. There was a seed treatment lawsuit, in case you missed it. It's settled already. The court threw it out and dismissed it. Basically, the beekeepers and some environmental groups had filed suit asking that EPA mandate or regulate a bag of seed the same they would a jug of chemical. But there is a treated article clause that allows EPA to regulate it up to the application, and the application is on the seed. So the courts dismissed that. Flubendiamide, I'll pass on that one because that one got lost. Was appealed, but basically the appeal gave us a chance to be able to use existing stock. Paraquat is a new one that's out that EPA's saying that, hey, there's been some people that have misused the product and caused some poisonings. So we're going to make all of you have new training and new requirements and require some new packaging before you can even purchase this product. And so that was the initial release that they put out on where they're trying to go with Paraquat in claims to save lives. But, you know, it goes back to the point of that just a few people that are violating the law, you're going to impose a whole set of new restrictions and cost on everybody else that still is not going to prevent people from breaking the law. Unfortunately, that's the unfortunate situation that we're in this world, though, now that it just imposes more restrictions. So we have to kind of watch our neighbors and all and encourage everybody to use everything appropriately as the label states. I'm going to skip now down to the pyrethroid review registration, and I'm not going to get into a whole lot of details on the pyrethroid review registration except that they have just released their pyrethroid review registration. They have some concerns in the ecological aspects and some wildlife aspects. They haven't even got to the endangered species component yet. And so there are a whole lot of pyrethroids that are at risk right now in EPA review process. And a lot of the extension colleagues across the country have been great to assist me whenever we're trying to reach out. And, you know, if I need some quick answers, I can blanket a message out to all of them, and they've been great to respond back quickly and help me get the information to try to provide the best information back to EPA to try to work through protection of these products. A few points that I want to make, too, on some of the recent activities is Endangered Species Act. And I know that a lot of y'all know what the Endangered Species Act is, but just in case you don't, it basically was a law that was put in place that said protect all the critters no matter if it bankrupts the country. It doesn't do any risk benefits. It doesn't try to say how big is the cost or whatever. It doesn't care whether you need it or not. It says if we need to protect that critter, then protect that critter. It doesn't matter if it's a snail or a flea that someone found and or thinks that they found, and it protects the habitat conducive for that critter. Okay? That's endangered species. FIFRA tells EPA to do a risk-benefits balance. Endangered Species Act tells Fish and Wildlife to protect the species. But the Endangered Species Act also tells EPA anything that you do that may affect endangered species, you have to get a buy-off from Fish and Wildlife. When Fish and Wildlife says, well, we're required to have a biological opinion, EPA says our data shows, and Fish and Wildlife says your data is done on what you call representative species. We don't believe there's any representative species. And you can't do the studies on the endangered species. So our biological opinion is more important. And the two do not work well. The two laws totally conflict with each other. And the two laws are creating massive lawsuits against EPA, against the country, so that we're paying out over and over because of the conflicts between these two, and there's no one that really can come up with a good solution on that yet. And it's slowing down registration process, and EPA themselves acknowledges it's not sustainable. They are required by law to get so many things done, but they can't do it because they can't move the stuff through Fish and Wildlife. So we got some major problems with that right now. Another one is that EPA has released this year a notice that they are now going to start mandating resistance management on all products, herbicides, pesticides, and fungicides. They haven't decided out yet what it's going to require, but they have moved into the authority for all resistance management. We're opposing that right now, and that's all comments that are going in. They're reviewing those comments and have not come out with a final decision at this point. So that's kind of where I'm going to leave it. I've only left a minute anyway, so thank y'all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Don.